I have two readings today, one of which is attributed to the Buddha from one of the Buddha sutras, and one to one of the great Protestant theologians of our time, Reinhold Niebuhr. I want to start with the Buddha's comments. In it, he's talking about what makes, in his language, a man, excuse the gender-specific nature of it, what makes a man great. And he's talking about a Brahmin, which in his context was one of the highest social classes. It was, in a sense, the great men, the movers and shakers were the Brahmin of his day. And Buddha, in this passage, wants to talk about what really makes a great man or a great woman, what really makes a Brahmin a Brahmin. Him I call Brahmin, who without hurting any creatures, whether feeble or strong, does not kill or cause slaughter. Him I call indeed a Brahmin, who is tolerant with the intolerant, mild with the violent, and free from greed among the greedy. Him I call indeed a Brahmin, who from anger and hatred, pride and hypocrisy, have dropped like a mustard seed at the point of a needle. Him I call indeed a Brahmin, who utters true speech, instructive and free from harshness. Him I call indeed a Brahmin, who takes nothing in the world that is not given him, be it long or short, small or large, good or bad. And this from Reinhold Niebuhr. Nothing that is really worth doing can be achieved in just one lifetime. Therefore, we must be saved by hope. Nothing which is true or beautiful or good makes complete sense in the immediate context of history. Therefore, we must be saved by faith. And nothing we do, however virtuous, can be accomplished alone. Therefore, we must be saved by love. And no virtuous act is quite as virtuous from the standpoint of our friend or foe as it is from our own standpoint. Therefore, we must be saved in the end by the final form of love, which is forgiveness. There is a story in the Buddhist tradition about an evening long, long ago when the Buddha had taken a vow of poverty along with so many of his brothers and sisters who walked the path that he walked. They took a vow of poverty, and how they ate was to carry their alms bowls about and to beg for enough food to keep going and to ask for the generosity of those who would let them into their homes. And on this one particular night, the Buddha, whose name was Siddhartha Gautama, Siddhartha was invited to the home of a wealthy Brahmin, sort of a man of the highest echelons of power and authority, and he was invited to his home for dinner. And because the Buddha had taken a vow of poverty and lived according to the alms of others, he was very excited to show up at this grand house and take a seat at the table and hopefully get himself a good hearty dinner that will keep him going for another day or so. So he came to the house and he sat down. But instead of entertaining him or providing him with food, this wealthy Brahmin launched into a loud and vocal tirade against Siddhartha. He told him that he was a total hack, that he was a false prophet, he was a loser, he was a bum, he was leading people astray, he was making them lazy. The Brahmin used all the salty language he could think of, and he cussed and he spit and he worked himself into a frenzy. And in response to all of this, the Buddha quietly responded, "Do people often accept your dinner invitations, good Brahmin?" "Oh, yes," the Brahmin said. "What do you do when they come?" "Oh, usually," he said, "we prepare a sumptuous feast." "What do you do if your guests are not hungry or they refuse to receive the meal?" "Why, we gladly partake of all the dishes we have prepared ourselves." "Well, good Brahmin," said the Buddha, "you have invited me for alms and entertained me with abuse, which I decline to accept, so now it belongs to you." And he got up and he walked out of the door, refusing to take upon his own shoulders the baggage of someone else's scorn. He left that feast for that guy. He left that bitter gall of resentment right there where it started in that home. When offered anger, the Buddha basically said, "It's all right, you can keep it." And he went on his way. And that seems like the logical thing to do, I know. When someone offers you shame and scorn and cruelty, even grievous injury, unendurable pain, when someone offers you that in exchange for just sitting down to take part in their lives, it seems a logical thing to do to just get up, get out of there, politely excuse yourself from the day or decade or half a lifetime that you spent being injured, and say, "You know what, you can keep all that for yourself because I got places to be." But the truth is that though it seems the logical thing to do, it's not what most of us most often do. Because pain is real, and wrongs are real, and wrongs are not necessarily washed away by the act of getting up and leaving the table of our abuse. Because nothing really makes it go away. We get up from the table of persecution, the place where we were most grievously injured, and we take with us, like one last dark gift, all of the attendant anger, resentment, and self-doubt that are the byproducts of our torment. We heap our begging bowls full of the Brahmin's scorn. We carry it right out the door with us, and we hang on to it as if it were a golden cup, a treasure that we should never part with. Why do we think that resentment is such a fabulous gift, so worthy of clinging to? Why do we accept it when it's given to us? Why are we so willing to take upon ourselves the emotional implications of other people's damaging behaviors? Why do we say yes to resentment when we have already been heaped with scorn? It is, I think, like someone giving you a box of crap for Christmas and you actually saying, "Gee, thanks, how thoughtful. I am so glad this crap is a part of my life. I think I shall keep it forever." We choose to carry these things with us. All the things that Siddhartha politely left behind, and in so doing, we sentence ourselves, not the other person, to the continued presence of resentment, of hatred, of anger. We diminish our own souls rather than give up the dark fool's gold of resentment. I have carried that fool's gold around with me at times. I know I will carry it again. And there are times, brief times, when holding on to one's anger is an act of willful and necessary self-preservation. There are times when one's sense of self is shattered and confidence gone and hope so diminished as to seem invisible. And there are times when it feels like all that's left of a truly wounded person's personality is their anger, their permission, and their power to be angry. There are times when anger is all one has, and I don't deny that. There are times when being angry and righteously resentful is the only thing that gets our butts out of the chair at that table of our oppression and gets us out the door in the first place. But those times of bitter self-preservation are not meant to last forever. The burst of fear mixed with anger that moves us out of the most traumatic situations we face, it only gets us so far. And there comes a point when the resentment that once protected us has outlived its usefulness, and it's no longer justified by its utility. It becomes, instead of a lifeline, a painful and heavy burden that drags us down into further depths to which we dare not sink if we ever want to come up for air. Resentment is a heavy burden. Like Atlas holding the whole world on his mighty shoulders, it's almost too large to carry. And over time, its weight only grows more burdensome, its pressure yet stronger, bending the back and coiling the form of she who holds it for the longest. Forgiveness withheld is a weight upon the soul. It crushes it bit by bit, year by year, into something infinitely less than it is capable of being. It corrodes our inherent goodness, self-worth, and generosity of spirit into smallness, self-protection, and bitterness. Thus, we come to forgiveness. If only for our own sakes, we come to forgiveness because we think our own souls are worth saving. Forgiveness is burdening of such a weight. It is the lifting off of our shoulders of the dark gift that we should never have accepted. It is something that we are called to do, first of all, for ourselves, because we ourselves are worth fighting for. It is something that you might be called to do because your own soul is too glorious to be crushed by the burdens other people have given you and you have willingly received. We come to forgiveness because having a soul is more important than clinging to anger. Chinese Zen master Qing Yen said, "To be angry is to let other people's mistakes punish yourself. To forgive others is to be good to yourself." Forgive in order to be good to yourself. Forgive in order to love yourself. To forgive is to do for yourself what other people cannot. It is to refuse the dark gift of resentment and turn instead to face your own self-worth. For me to forgive would be to acknowledge that my soul matters as much or more than my anger ever did. And this week, as I have been pondering forgiveness, I've also been pondering about a word that we use a lot here. And that word is justice. Justice. Justice is something that we're always fond of saying we're seeking in this world, and at its best we are. In its best form, justice is something we work for, something responsible people will do anything to uphold, but justice, I think, has a shadow side as well. Because justice is too often understood, even among us, as an evening of the score. A squaring away of inequalities, a wiping clean of debt. And I cannot remember one single time in my entire life when keeping score of my resentments or trying to even them up ever, ever had a remotely positive effect. There is such a thing as justice. And in certain settings, justice is a vital and important concept. But in my own heart, I think I've always had better luck when I sought out compassion rather than justice. And I'm wondering if forgiveness, after all is said and done, doesn't entail giving up on justice. Giving up on the idea that everything should, could, or ever will be equal, and choosing instead to seek compassion. If getting or receiving justice means evening the score, I'm not even sure it's possible. For how could you really even the score of a broken heart? How could you ever even the score of a life lost meaninglessly? How could you even the score of a child left uncared for? There is no eye for eye, tit for tat, no validation and vindication that can wipe those pains away. Nothing can even such a score. And thus, to do justice in that sense is a futile exercise. It's the pursuit of a ghost you can never catch. And when, as happens so often, a prisoner dies on death row through the contrived argument that a family will receive closure and the abstract concept of justice has been done, I cannot help but think that that score, after all that, can never be even, and that the pursuit of justice from a spiritual sense is a blind alley that's very hard to back out of. The pursuit of an even score is self-conscious, calculating, and full of second-guessing. It involves dedicating oneself to the pursuit of an ungraspable and always fleeting phantom, and the trouble of it all is that one is consumed with the pursuit of a ghost, and when they are consumed with such things, they can't be consumed with all the wonderful things that ought to be consuming them in this precious life. As theologian Lewis Smead has said, to forgive is to surrender the right to get even, because forgiving is always a decision to put up with an uneven score. It is a decision to put up with an uneven score because you want something more out of your life than an even score. Because the score could never be evened anyway, because we learned in kindergarten that the world ain't fair, and because compassion has always been a higher virtue than fairness. In our child dedication ceremonies, I often touch the head of each child and I say, I dedicate you to the service of truth, the pursuit of justice, and the ever-present source of all love. And I'm wondering if in fact I should say, I dedicate you to the service of truth, the pursuit of compassion, and the ever-present source of all love. In the end, I can't help but feel that it's not an even score, but an open heart that will save us. Forgiveness is, in that way, a leap of faith. A leap of faith that is at times a deeply nonsensical act. It breaks all the common patterns of human behavior that so often include competition and the settling of scores. It is illogical in that way. In that its inherently uneven score means that it really has very little to do with repentance. See, I think that finding forgiveness and giving forgiveness from one's own heart has little to do with whether or not the person you're forgiving says they're sorry. Maybe they're sorry. Maybe they aren't. Maybe they're not even self-aware enough to acknowledge that a wrong was done. Maybe they're so mired in their own resentments that they can't see through the corrosion of their own spirits. Maybe they, like all the rest of us, from time to time, are burdened and alone and blind. But their burden is not yours to lift. Their pain is not yours to heal. And their complicity is not required for you to fully and graciously offer your forgiveness, whether or not they choose to accept. If we hold on to our forgiveness, withhold it until someone gets around to repenting, we may be waiting a very long time. And while we wait, the person who has wronged us once again holds all the cards, consolidates all the power, and keeps us from becoming the expansive souls we might become. John, my husband, reminded me just yesterday about a quote from Forrest Church, who's one of our Unitarian Universalist ministers, who said, "Be careful who you choose as enemies, because you just might tend to become them." Be careful who you choose as enemies, for their resentment might become yours. Their dark gift may, in fact, become yours. But forgiveness frees the forgiver. It makes room for better things. It clears the way for higher visions. And I think quite literally that forgiveness takes power away from evil. It loosens the bonds that hold us hostage, and it lets us focus on what we ourselves are called to be. It is a golden gift we can give ourselves. There's a story that has been told for hundreds of years, since the Middle Ages. It's a story about a nun who claims that she has had a vision of Christ himself. And she goes to her bishop. She's all excited, and she tells him that she has seen Christ. And the bishop says, "Sister, did you talk to him?" She says, "Yes, I did." And the bishop, being inherently suspicious, wants to verify that it was in fact Christ that she had seen. And he continued, he said, "If you have another vision, sister, ask Christ this question. Ask him, what was the bishop's great sin before he became a bishop?" Having learned to keep a secret, he knew that only God and his own confessor would know, so only God could say it accurately. And about 3 months later, the woman came back, the nun came back. And when she came in, he said to her, "Did you see our Lord again, sister?" She said, "Yes." "Did you ask him the question about my sin?" "Of course I did." "And what did he say?" She smiled and said, "The Lord said, I don't remember anymore." Because the Lord had other things to think about. Better things to focus on than holding on to the petty sins of some self-centered country bishop who is foolish enough to imagine that God just can't stop dwelling about his sins. "I don't remember anymore," God might have said, "because I've got better things to do than worry myself over your problems. I don't remember anymore because you are forgiven and the burden of anger is not mine to bear, and by the way, I'm busy." We don't forgive just as an act of generosity to the wrongdoer. We forgive at least in part to free our own souls for more constructive and more rewarding work like living and loving. Resentment is that one final dart gift from those who cause us injury. It's a gift that just keeps giving. Sorrow, regret, shame, disillusionment. It is our task to give up such a gift, to refuse it, to walk away, to turn around, to shut the door as the Buddha once did, and turn toward the rest of our lives, free to love, to seek compassion, to seek that which makes us whole, to be something more than a victim. Let us value ourselves enough to let go. Let us honor our own potential enough to let it blossom unencumbered by resentment. Let us seek compassion rather than justice, kindness rather than vindication, and open hearts rather than even scores. May it be so. And amen.